Arizona, Massachusetts, and Florida have issued statewide emergency declarations. If New York were to declare the opioid crisis a public health emergency,
more quickly to unlock resources and take stronger measures, at least those state lawmakers who signed a letter urging Hochul to declare an emergency so that it could, you know, help with staffing issues, allow community-based organizations to improve their overdose prevention services, address some of the issues with reimbursement and costs for treatment, which can be a big obstacle for folks trying to access substance use treatment services. But again, it just doesn't seem like something that the governor is likely to do. And this issue, which has, you know, been in the mix for a couple of years now, kind of surfaced once more earlier this year during a meeting of the Opioid Settlement Fund Advisory Board, which is a state group that is tasked with making recommendations for the allocation of money that New York State received from settlements with pharmaceutical companies that drove the opioid crisis. Members of the board were in a recent meeting discussing whether or not they should press the governor on this issue. Some felt very strongly that part of their responsibility on this advisory board would be to do just that. Others weren't quite so sure. They felt that, you know, they should really stick with making specific recommendations about these funds. But I think for the folks that are really on the front lines of this issue, it's kind of a no-brainer. They want the governor to make this measure and just really use any tool at their disposal to counter this ongoing crisis.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Eliza Fawcett of HealthBeat New York. HealthBeat is a team at Civic News Company and KFF Health News working to report the story of public health in America. And we're talking specifically about whether or not New York State's opioid crisis should be declared a public emergency. Advocates are pushing for that declaration, but so far, Governor Kathy Hochul has resisted those calls. What has the governor's administration said recently about this, Eliza?
Well, when I asked them about this issue, they didn't really address it directly, but highlighted, you know, their efforts to address the opioid crisis. And, you know, the governor is not unsympathetic to this issue at all. In fact, she often, talks about losing a nephew to an overdose. And, you know, it isn't understands the gravity of the situation, I'd say, and takes it seriously. But again, for folks who are especially working in harm reduction, particularly those in communities that are continuing to see deaths very regularly, I think that's just not enough, and they want more from the state.
And the advisory board, the Opioid Settlement Fund Advisory Board, as it's specifically called. There are, as you said, members there who want to hold the governor accountable, want to push for this, but then also are expressing caution about straying too far from their task, which is allocating these settlement funds. And they're also talking about how they need to have a little bit more transparency. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So this board is tasked with making recommendations. They don't, you know, have the ultimate say over, you know, how this money is used. They simply are looking at the issues and offering recommendations for how they think it should be used. And there has been some tension in previous meetings over whether or not, particularly New York City, is using the money well. Some of the members of the board have called the city out for what they see as a lack of transparency over its use of funds, particularly involving those funds that are designated for community relief. They feel that New York hasn't exactly shown how that money has been used, and they're frustrated with the city on that front. The board every year puts out a report. It's due on November 1st. So right now, board members are focused on figuring out what their recommendations for this year will be. That report will come out again on November 1st, and we'll see what the recommendations are. But again, just to kind of think about the big picture here, I mean, New York State received billions of dollars in settlement funds. So, you know, it's a huge task to figure out how exactly those funds should be broken down and designated, who should receive them, and really just like how the state can best address this ongoing crisis. So they have a big task in front of them, and I think that the members of the board are trying to think thoughtfully about how to do that. But they're having these points of tension both over the state's response and the governor's lack of declaring a public health emergency, and how these specific communities and municipalities have or have not effectively used that money they've received.
And a spokesperson for Governor Hochul said in a statement, quote, "Our administration is engaged in aggressive ongoing efforts to address the opioid and overdose epidemic, which has tragically taken far too many neighbors, friends, and family members in New York and across the nation." The statement went on to say, "Our efforts are making an impact, as recently released federal data showed that overdose deaths are declining across New York, and we're working every day to keep deploying the resources that save lives and ensure New Yorkers struggling with addiction get the support they need," end quote. The opioid advisory panel is scheduled to meet tomorrow. Settlement Fund Advisory Board, scheduled to meet tomorrow. I suppose that's to help get that report for November 1st together, but I wonder if this topic is going to come up again.
It might. I mean, I think, again, they're trying to figure out what their recommendations will be for this next report. And certainly from the last meeting, it didn't seem like this issue was decided. It may well come up again as they figure out what their recommendations will be.
And before we let you go, Eliza, I wanted to just touch on Eastern equine encephalitis, which we've talked to you about before. On Friday, New York State reported its first case of Eastern equine encephalitis, also known as Triple E. That's in nearly a decade. And that rare mosquito-borne virus was detected right next door here in Ulster County. Can you tell us any more about that?
Sure. So Triple E is it's a very rare but a serious and often fatal infection that is spread to humans through mosquitoes. There is no treatment or vaccine available. There have been human cases in Massachusetts earlier this year, and up until the New York State case that was reported last week, they had been seeing cases in horses, but not yet in humans. So, it is somewhat concerning to hear of a human case. Although the health department recommends that while people of all ages are susceptible to infection, it's really folks who are 50 years or older or younger than 15 who are at greatest risk of acquiring the virus. And what's most important for everyone to do is to just try your best to avoid getting a mosquito bite. Wearing long clothing, using bug spray, not having, bare skin out as much as you can, from dusk till dawn, which is when mosquitoes tend to be out and about.
New York State Department of Health said that the individual who tested positive is hospitalized. The Ulster County Department of Health is currently investigating the case. And as you mentioned, this is spread from mosquito bites, so be sure to protect yourself. And if people do develop symptoms, and it's important to note that most people with Triple E do not develop symptoms, but for those who do, symptoms can include fever, headache, vomiting, diarrhea, seizures, behavioral changes, and drowsiness, according to the CDC, and you should seek medical help. Eliza Fawcett from HealthBeat, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll take a break. There'll be more Radio Chatskill after this.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, there is something that most of us do all the time that we think makes us more efficient, but it doesn't.
It turns out the faster people switch attention, the greater is their stress.
For the vast majority of us, multitasking does not work. There are a few outliers.
We didn't believe they existed early on.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio, Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World, Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on the world, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Last week, Ty Cobalt of Gardner, New York, pleaded guilty to manslaughter in a fatal hit-and-run case. It's one of at least four fatal vehicle-pedestrian accidents in the Mid-Hudson Valley this year. Three of those accidents in Ulster County were also hit-and-run incidents. The Times Union's Philip Pantuso has more.
This was the case back in January where a man struck a 22-year-old SUNY New Paltz student named Raymond Rattray and left him by the side of the road where his body was discovered the following day. He was arrested back in May, and yesterday a court entered a guilty plea. He pleaded guilty to second-degree manslaughter specifically and also leaving the scene of an incident without reporting a death had occurred. Both of those crimes are felonies. He's going to be sentenced in December, and he faces between 28 months and 7 years in prison. 7 years is the maximum sentence for felony leaving the scene. He had previously faced 5 to 15 years for manslaughter. I'll note that this is the exact same plea agreement with the exact same sentence that the woman who struck a 21-year-old in Saugerties and then also fled the scene agreed to just last month. In that case, she had some help from her husband to try to conceal the crime. They basically staged an accident, and he was charged with insurance fraud. So he pleaded to a lesser charge in that case as well. But yeah, this was one of three cases in Ulster County alone so far this year involving vehicle and pedestrian fatalities. The third one was in the town of Marlborough, where two people in their 70s were struck and killed by a woman from Newburgh, who then fled the scene. Her charges are pending, and she's being held without bail right now in Ulster County Jail. And then there was a fourth, very high-profile case in Dutchess County in Red Hook a couple of months ago, where a Bard graduate who had actually graduated earlier that day was struck by a vehicle that jumped the curb in the village of Red Hook. That driver did not flee the scene. And, every couple of weeks I check in with the Red Hook Police Department and no charges have been filed yet. So I think it sounds like they're still trying to determine whether that was just an accident or what liability the driver in that case might have. But yeah, just a real big spate. I mean, I can't remember anything like this in the 7 years now I've been covering news in the Hudson Valley. A spate of pedestrian accidents like this.
Yeah, and it seems that, I mean, anecdotally, we could say, hey, we don't remember anything like this right here. But it also seems that there are numbers across the state that indicate that these types of accidents have gone up. The vehicle accidents in general, but also vehicle accidents involving pedestrians. I know this isn't the story you were reporting on, but is that getting any attention either from lawmakers, policymakers, advocates, or is anybody making any moves on this news?
Well, Ulster County has definitely spent a lot of time and attention on this. This summer, County Executive Jen Metzger initiated this. I can't remember the exact name of the program, but it was basically like a three-pronged safe streets program that involved education and increased law enforcement. And they're also going to increase the spending on like cameras and signage to try to curb reckless driving. There have also been a number of cities that have taken advantage of a fairly new state law that allows municipalities to lower the speed limit from 30 miles per hour to 25 miles per hour on locally owned streets. Kingston and Hudson have done that in recent weeks. I believe Albany did as well, and I think maybe White Plains. So some steps have been taken. You know, it's something that I think is probably worth a deeper and more comprehensive look, which, I'm hoping to do something on that in the coming months.
Well, and I know we'll be talking about it if you do. Meanwhile, all these stories are up now at timesunion.com, and we've been talking to Philip Pantuso. Philip, thank you so much for going over all this.
You got it. Take care.
Jason Dole speaking to the Times Union's Philip Pantuso. We'll take a break, and when we come back, what will the interest rate cut mean for the five areas of our financial lives? James B. Huntington is here with details next.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
It's Monday. That means we're checking in with local economist and author James B. Huntington for the latest local economic perspective. James B., hello.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, we missed you last week, and seems there was a little bit of news from the Fed. But before we get to that, let's talk locally about some unemployment, the latest on unemployment in our listening area.
Yes, these are July numbers. They show that Sullivan County had 3.5% unemployment, which is up 0.3% from June. Orange was 3.9%, also up 0.3%. Ulster, 4.1%, up 0.5%. Wayne County, 3.6%, stayed there. And Pike County, up to 4.7%, which was 0.2% higher. The national, though, as for July, was 4.5%. So even though we have the increases here, we're still doing well, as four of the five counties did better than the national one. So I think we're still doing well. If we can come in this much less than what the entire U.S. is having, then we're doing the job here.
Right. And as I mentioned, that news was the Federal Reserve slashed interest rates the first time since March 2020. Let's remind folks what they did and how big of a move it was.
Well, this was on Wednesday. The Federal Reserve decided to cut the benchmark rate it uses by 0.5% instead of 0.25%. So it was, forecasters were split between which one of those two things it was going to be, and it came out a little heavy. So the 0.25% was already baked into the cake of investment prices and such. So they had a very good couple of days after this happened, but it's not surprising. I mean, I thought this was a clear-cut decision for them to make, because the last time when they brought interest rates down, or they didn't bring interest rates down last time, they held. And there was news that came out the next day, the very next day, about unemployment, indicating that they probably should have cut rates. And since then, it's seemed even worse for unemployment and better for inflation. So going after unemployment seems like the right thing to do, and 0.5% is certainly not excessive. From here, they will decide what happens with the data that comes out in the future, starting with the jobs report, which will be a week from Friday now. So we'll see where we're going from here, but it seems appropriate. And yes, the markets and other commodity markets ate it up.
They liked it. And so do we think that the Fed will pencil in a few more rate cuts before the end of the year?
Well, they're only meeting twice, so that's that it can only possibly be two, but it's really going to depend on the data that comes in. When we get the jobs report, it will tell really how we had been doing. It's not the same as a reaction to the rate cut, but it'll show mid-September what things were last week especially. And if that continues to go up, they will cut rates more. If unemployment stays the same, or it dropped a tenth of a point percentage point last time, if it does that again, then they probably will reduce rates a quarter of a point or not at all. But if it keeps getting higher, it also depends on what's happening with inflation, because that was the real reason for them pushing up rates as high as they were. So they don't know. I mean, they will never really know in advance what they'll be doing. They would like to be able to keep decreasing it, but the data is going to have to support that.
They're walking that fine line, as always. So, it showed the economy. It was help for the economy, but what does it mean in real terms for you, me, and the listener here? What are the five areas of our financial lives that will get impacted by this cut in rates?
Yes. Well, this is an article that came out late last week in the New York Times, so the title I lifted for proposing it for this show. So the question is, what will it mean? And, well, going down the list here, the conclusions they have are auto rates. They're described as elevated. They have been high for some time. Maybe the problem with some cars, electric cars in particular, is they're not holding its value, is their value as well, and so that hurts when they're figuring out how much interest to charge on these things in case they default. So probably they will go down close to the 0.5%, not much more than that. It should not be any more than that, and it may not be much. It's dependent really on other factors, but you can look for a small improvement if you're thinking about getting a car soon. Credit cards, that's where no change, nothing is going to change. They are so high in relation to other interest rates that 0.5% would be invisible anyway. So there's not going to be anything there, very much the same. Mortgages, though, could easily go down another, the full 0.5% and so on. The problem with mortgages lately is that housing prices themselves have been high. It's a shortage of supply in general around the country. It varies a lot. So it still is favorable. If you're thinking about buying a house, it will probably be a little bit better. And in fact, I read that mortgage rates have already gone down a little bit since Wednesday's rate cut. Savings accounts and CDs, nets, we have some haven't gone down. It's interesting. I was looking at my bank, and the rates on some of the CDs are exactly the same as they were 2 weeks ago. And so they can be quite substantial. What probably will not be as good as if you have a money market checking account or something. That's likely to be the first line of decreasing one way or another. So you may have improvements, you may not. I mean, do your comparison shopping as always, if you're thinking about buying a CD. Then we have student loans. Probably no change. They are so messed up with all the forgiving and proposed forgiving and such going on that there are a lot of banks now and even credit unions don't want to offer student loans, things where you could just automatically walk in 10 years ago and get one. Now they're saying, no, we don't want to even offer them anymore. They are quite low. They say 6.53% on average for undergraduates. That's awfully nice given that the rate for before the interest rate hit the federal funds rate was less than 2 points below that. So, yes, you can consider that, but probably not much of a change, no change on student loans because of this.
Well, yeah, and in all of these five areas of your financial life, if you're going to shop around, just buyer beware, make sure you get extra quotes and look at any of the rates and credit cards especially, see what all of that means. But now that the interest rates have been cut or falling, what are some of the economic areas that we should pay more attention to now?
Well, we've been focused, or the commentators and such have been had a laser focus on these interest rates and will they go down and how much they will go down, so on. But there are other things going and some warnings, some problems that the economy may have, or world problems that may come back to the economy. A lot of tensions and hostilities around the planet, from the Middle East to Ukraine to what China's going to do or not do, not only with Taiwan, but the South China Sea and the military bases they've been putting up in the high seas and such. Also problems with the U.S. with a lot of uncertainty and disturbance about the upcoming election, what it will mean, and the candidate from either party that gets elected, what they might do or not do, from tariffs, heavy pervasive tariffs being suggested on one side to possibly high social program expenses on the other. We don't really know, but it's all kind of unknown at this point. So generally, the author of this, Jeff Sommer, said that it was generally good times, but there are things here that could go wrong, and also the stock market could be overpriced because by a lot of measures, I mean, back to there is some of the new fancier ones that are going on now, the CAPE ratio and Tobin's Q, back to the old timers like the price earnings ratio, the stock market is looking awfully high. And if the enthusiasm stays there, I mean, there's a massive amount of money that has to go somewhere, it will do fine, but it is possible there's probably more chance than there would usually be that there will be a correction or at least a slow calendar year overall.
Well,
in that area,
before we get to the numbers, I guess folks always think the stock market is a little bit like gambling, but there's actually a Wall Street firm that has its new recruits play poker. They teach them how to play poker. Why is that?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's a I mean, I'm biased. I've played a great deal of poker at some fairly high levels. And the insight they're getting in Wall Street is generally that it's a very good model for making decisions with imperfect information. Also, the need to act fast. So if you're evaluating a poker hand and figuring out what to do with it, I mean, poker is, of course, a game where people bet on the values of their hands, and they don't know what their opponents have, and they don't know what cards are going to be coming up to change the value of what they have. So they're doing a lot of it. They're doing sort of, they're practicing and learning poker so that they can get an idea of how to respond fast and how to handle information coming in from different sources, because that's a lot of what commodities trading is really like. I mean, people don't spend a couple hours thinking. Often they just go very fast,
yeah.
And they have to decide something is underpriced or overpriced, and that means they need to buy or sell right then. And that's quite similar to poker, where if you watch a casino poker, they're always moving. They play fast, fast, fast. So it's looking like a good idea. There's always been connections between poker and things like options trading, with a lot of people being highly skilled at both. So they're discovering it, or even more, and they're using this, and they're quite happy with the results, really. Yeah. The college students and such, the people, the new employees with high potential, and they're doing better if they understand more about poker.
Yeah. This is a trading firm, Susquehanna International, that has recruits spend at least 100 hours playing cards during their 10-week training program. It's an article in the Wall Street Journal, and it mentions that Jeff Yass, who is Susquehanna's co-founder, sometimes joins in and scrutinizes the hands that new hires play to gauge how effectively they bluff. So intense.
Yeah, not only bluff, but how good were your plays?
Yeah.
Beyond the results that came in, you have to realize if you're going to work on becoming a skilled poker player or many other games, you have to see the difference between something that was successful and something that should have been successful or was not successful. Sometimes you will get really burned by bad cards and such that came up when you played with the odds, when you made really the right play. And straightening out people's thinking on that and getting them to understand what they should have been doing. They can,
yeah.
So they're having recaps on some of these sessions with these established experts and such, and they're finding out, well, this play that worked was not really very good, or this play that did not work was the right thing to do, and so on and so forth.
Well, let's see what risk paid off last week. What are the numbers in the stock market and oil, precious metal, and all those prices? How'd they change?
Yes, okay. Well, these are two-week changes I have here. So gold is 26.16 plus 125. That's an all-time high or close to it. What's happening is in India, which is the world's largest gold market as far as people buying it just for personal use and such, they did away with a 9% tariff they had, and demand went way up and it hit the gold price quite quickly. So it's doing very well. Silver did even better in relative terms, $30.42. The ratio there between gold and silver is 86 to 1. That's lower, but it's still high. So it's saying that silver may still be underpriced, even though it's over $30. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 42,063 early this morning. That's up 1,700 and some. That's, again, an all-time high or close to it. NASDAQ did even better proportionally at 17,948 plus 1,257. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $71.12 the barrel, up $2.51. But pump prices have started to move. It was lower a week ago. It was in the mid-60s. It's gone up in the past week or so in my local station anyway, dumped from 359 to 329. Very surprising, but it's looking good there. Bitcoin, 63,598 plus 9,200. That almost exactly canceled out what it did the previous 2 weeks. It's within a few dollars. So it's jumping all over the place, but it's almost exactly where it was 4 weeks ago. British pound, 1.3265. Up 1.7 cents. Euro, 1.1096, up 52 hundredths of a cent. Both of those were helped by the interest rate cut over here. People are now looking more to go to countries that are going to have higher interest rates or better deals. And the Japanese 100 yen held at 70 cents. It's in a better place anyway. So overall, this is great stuff. The question is, will it continue? What will we see first? 35,000 or 45,000 on the Dow, and so on. I could say the same for the others. We'll see. Very much unknown, but there's no complaining now.
Well, you'll keep an eye on it, and we'll check in with you next Monday. James B. Hunting with local economic news and perspective right here. Working 9 to 5, what a way to. Thank you, James B. We'll talk to you next Monday.
Thank you, listeners.
All right, we'll take a break. Back with more Radio Chatskill right after this.
I'm Matt Hurtado. Join me on a journey where pixels meet melodies and controllers become conductors. This is Virtual Soundscapes, the show that transports you to the sonic realms of video game magic. In this journey, we'll uncover the hidden treasures of video game soundtracks from the classics to modern day and speak with industry veterans. Join me every Thursday night at 10 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Now, acclaimed jazz artist Johnny King. Normally, you'd have to travel to a Manhattan jazz club to see him perform, but he'll be right here this weekend at Delaware Highlands Conservancy's Taste of the Harvest Festival. Delaware Highlands Conservancy works to preserve clean water, farmland, and forests. Here's Rosie Starr.
Johnny King is a person with a trio of talents. He is a trial lawyer with a practice that concentrates on intellectual property. Johnny King is a jazz pianist who performs in New York City and tours with a trio of musicians. He authors books and articles and is an avid angler. Fly fishing is so sacred to him, he ties his own flies. Johnny King, our listeners may be familiar with you from Radio Catskill's Living Jazz, hosted by Thane Peterson. Welcome back to our airwaves, and please say hello to our audience again.
Hi, Rosie. It's great to see you and great to participate in your radio show and talk about jazz and fly fishing and the Upper Delaware.
Here we are in Milanville, Pennsylvania. Perhaps you have a connection to the Delaware Highlands Conservancy.
You know, I've been a lifelong jazz musician and I've played all around the world, but generally we're playing in big cities, festivals, jazz clubs, and it's rare we play in an environment like this, a rural area, but this is a community and area with which I have a long, long connection. So back in 1998, my wife Jacqueline and I got married about 200 feet from where we're sitting right now, at our friend Louise's house. That's where we had our wedding reception. We used to come up almost every weekend. That's when I started fishing the Delaware River. I've been a fisherman my whole life. Fell in love with the place and just came up here as much as we could. And until recently, I'd leave the city, because I live in New York City, at crack of dawn, fish till 10 o'clock at night, get home at 1 in the morning, and then either go to work the next day as a lawyer or have a gig or rehearsal the next day. We finally purchased a house up here on the river about 3 years ago, but we've been coming up here forever. And my wife, Jacqueline, has always been very involved with conservation up here and is now board member of the Delaware Highlands Conservancy. But we've known about it forever because we knew Barbara when she had the butterfly barn with Ed. We used to take our daughters there and Ed would teach them about the butterflies. But this is a sacred, sacred place. So like I said, it's rare to play a gig in an environment like this. It happens sometimes, but I love the idea of supporting this organization and this area. There's nothing like the Delaware River anywhere else in the world or the United States, and I fished, you name it, Montana, Wyoming, South America, Canada. But this is a special place, a special river that has all kinds of unique qualities, and we're thrilled to be here.
At the Cedar Lakes Estate private concert sponsored by the Delaware Highlands Conservancy, what's on tap for the 29th? How will you choose your playlist?
So the question is, we don't know, and that's kind of what being a jazz musician is about. I'm playing with a trio that I have a long, long connection to. Billy Drummond, the drummer, who is truly a legend, you know, has kind of the ultimate musical resume, Sonny Rollins, Freddie Hubbard, Bobby Hutcherson, Horace Silver, one of the most in-demand drummers in the world, also a professor at Juilliard. He and I have been playing together since the 1980s, since we were kids when he first moved to New York. And Dezron Douglas, the bass player, probably met about 10 or 15 years ago, but we now play regularly together, and I'd say he's probably top four or five most in-demand bassists in the world. So we're really lucky to have them. And I am also lucky because I play with these guys a lot in lots of different contexts, but a lot as a trio. We often play at a place called Mesro in New York. So we have a repertoire of songs. I kind of like showing up to a gig with no music and just calling tunes on the fly. Dezron and Billy, we've played together so much, I can call tunes off the top of my head. So maybe we'll play a handful of originals, but I think we have a set of maybe about an hour and 15 minutes. You know, maybe one song is going to be 5 minutes long, or it's going to be half an hour long. Kind of have to go and see what happens. That's the joy of being a jazz musician, right? If it were predictable, I wouldn't be doing it, or I'd be playing classical music.
Well, that being said, do you think about the audience, the age group, or the actual event and try and fit into it? Or do you just feel, like you said, it's jazz improv and you make it up as you go along?
I always think about the audience. So generally what I find is if you play something and it's sincere and the musicians look like they're engaged in it, if it's good music, people like it. You know, so I have two daughters who aren't particularly jazz fans. They love jazz. But what I noticed with them growing up is I could put on the most out there thing in the world, like late John Coltrane. But there's so much spirit, there's so much emotion in it, it just communicates to them. So it's not like I say, oh, this is an older audience, so I'm just going to play standards from the 30s. I might, but sometimes those things fall flat. I played a gig recently where a woman came up to us, and my guess is she's like maybe 28, 30. Turns out she's a beat producer, pretty successful rap beat producer. We played the most straight-ahead gig. I don't think we played a single song that was written after about 1932. And she was unbelievably into it. And it was just that reminder that people are not there to hear, like, genres of music. They're just there to hear sincere music. So we'll see what happens, right?
Let's talk about the importance of supporting organizations that enhance the quality of life in our community. I feel this way about our listeners who support WJFF Radio Catskill as their local NPR station. But today we're speaking about the Delaware Highlands Conservancy, and Taste of the Harvest is very much in support of that organization.
I alluded to this before, but it'd be hard to overstate how special this river valley is. So just to give you an example of, we all get different things from this. My wife is, as I said, on the board. She's out every morning, you know, attacking all the invasive species in our backyard. She was out pulling stilt grass and worrying over the knotweed this morning. My particular obsession is with the river and what's in it. It has one of the great wild trout populations in the United States. And you got the East Branch, the West Branch, and the main stem. And people are on the river all the time. But I'm telling you, if you're a fisherman and you're out there at dawn and you're out there late at night or even in the dark, you see things, hear things, and feel things that just nobody else gets to experience. It could be a hatch of mayflies. It could be a giant brown trout. It could be a striper that has somehow made it all the way from Philadelphia up here, or a shad, or an American eel, or seeing one of the water snakes eat a fish, or seeing the incredible bird life. So in the last 2 weeks, I've seen this incredible influx of ospreys. Hadn't seen them until about 2 weeks ago. The river just never ceases to surprise me, and it's 115 miles from New York City. And it's actually wilder and cleaner than most Montana rivers. So I think this is really, really something to preserve and support. So you ask about how to support it. I think we all support it in different ways. Some of us volunteer. Some of us play gigs for events honoring and recruiting support for the organization. Some of us write articles for the River Reporter. Some of us have radio shows to talk about it. I think there are a lot of ways to support it. If you're walking along the river and you pick up, you know, a Poland Spring bottle that someone left on the river, you're supporting it. But there's a way for us to all enjoy this river without spoiling this river and preserving it. There's also, I fished with a friend who's very involved in the water flow regulation, the frequent flow management plan. All of that stuff, it's a delicate balance, but somehow you have one of the cleanest rivers in the United States, and it's near some of the largest urban centers in the world. So I think we all sort of have to kick in whatever way we can.
You mentioned a memory of your children and learning jazz. And you also mentioned when we started prep for this conversation that your children were at the Butterfly Barn down the road. Can you share a memory of their experience at the early days of the Conservancy?
Sure. So they were little, right? And Ed, Barbara's partner, had a great way of explaining the life cycle of those monarch butterflies he kept. But the truth is, it's like the wildest thing in the world, right? They're migrating from so far. You feel like you can crush a butterfly if you just touch it. And they're making it back and forth to Mexico, right? Like, how is that even conceivably possible? I saw Cece and Lila sort of taking it in and not understanding it. I was thinking, how did I not know this? How am I so oblivious to this like incredible drama of this little bug that hatches out from this caterpillar, becomes this beautiful, you know, painted thing. It looks like a painting, and then is able to migrate across a continent. It was so mind blowing. And so Cece and Lila were sitting there kind of wide eyed, but I was thinking, I'm as wide eyed as they are. And so is Jacqueline, right? You know, maybe I knew it a little bit, but watching them there, and then Ed was intercepting them on their journey, right? That's what he did. He would intercept the butterflies, all sort of both for sort of preserving those ones so that they'd be okay, but also so that he could show kids and frankly, you know, adult kids like me, look at this thing. Here's just a little example of all the drama that's around you. And once I saw that, and this is something I always told my kids about, it's true of everything out there, right? So those eels, they look kind of gross, right? But they're going out to spawn in the Sargasso Sea and then coming back up here and swimming by my house. Think about where that, like, why are they going to the Caribbean, right? And so there's a million little dramas like that happening in the Delaware. And all you have to do is sit there and flip over a bunch of rocks, and you want, there are little monsters in there, right? And they're beautiful things. And those birds, where they come from, I just think you couldn't master what's out there if your life depended on it. And so those early encounters with Ed were sort of this kind of opening this window to all these little mysteries and dramas that were right there in the little puddles of water off the side of the river, you know, a couple hundred yards from where he was teaching us that stuff. You develop this reverence for this whole ecosystem, and you realize you can't be oblivious about it. You can't be complacent about it, because places like this are few and far between, and we all have access to it, right? We can all get in the river and splash around without anyone telling us to leave, and that's an amazing thing.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this conversation? You're an amazingly gifted and giving individual. Our community really appreciates you.
That's very nice of you, and the same, of course, goes for you. We'd hope to see some of you at the event. I really want you all to hear Dezron and Billy and what great musicians they are, because maybe you'll go out and stream some of their recordings or come check us out in the city. Please support the DHC, and please support this river system and this river valley, because it is holy land as far as I'm concerned. Thanks, Rosie.
On Sunday, September 29th, the Conservancy will host Taste of the Harvest, an event in Port Jervis that features the Johnny King Trio. He will be joined by Dezron Douglas on bass and Billy Drummond on drums. More information for this event is available online. Visit DelawareHighlands.org.
And thanks to Rosie Starr of Farm & Country for that. And remember to listen to Farm & Country every Saturday at 10 a.m. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cook breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Bolton. More information at greatwesterncatskills.com.
In another election year of uncharted waters, you can count on NPR News and this station for clear coverage and context to keep you informed as the election nears.
Radio Catskill, your NPR station.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, cooler with rain and drizzle, high of only 58, cloudy, low 51 tonight, and tomorrow, mostly cloudy, high 63, some showers back in the forecast Wednesday. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.